Hello and welcome to Focus on Business. I'm your host, Lee Strickland. On today's program, my guest is Grayson Randall, Vice President and Chief Technology Officer of Ascot Technologies, Inc., an award-winning software company specializing in mobile delivery technologies. Grayson is a former IBMer with 13 patents. He leads all the development and support efforts for Ascot Technologies, including new product development and deployment. He has over 30 years of experience in systems design and architecture. At IBM, he worked on projects involved with manufacturing, automation, digital video processing, set-top box designs, digital CPU design, and network processors for high-speed communications. He has experience as a team leader for international scale projects. Grayson is also very active in IEEE, and that stands for the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers. IEEE is the world's largest professional association dedicated to advancing technological innovation and excellence for the benefit of humanity. IEEE and its members inspire a global community through their highly cited publications, conferences, technology standards, and professional and educational activities. Within IEEE, Grayson is known as in the world of robotics for his leadership of the Insight Racing DARPA Grand Challenge, which we have got to hear about today, okay, which secured final and semifinal positions in the highly competitive autonomous robotic vehicles races. He previously mentored a first high school robotics team, which won first place in the 2004 international competition, as well as numerous other awards. He is currently working on a humanoid robot with a goal that it be indistinguishable from a real human. Grayson has held numerous leadership positions within IEEE related to robotics and automation and is currently the Eastern North Carolina Section Chair. Grayson's work has received many awards, including IEEE's USA Citation of Honor and the Region 3 Outstanding Engineer Award. He is also a distinguished speaker for IEEE Computer Society and a reviewer for the National Science Foundation. Whew. Impressive. Thank you for taking time to be on the show today, Grayson.
Well, thank you very much for having me today.
So let's first start out and talk about Ascot Technologies and kind of explain what you guys do and where you operate and what kind of clients you have.
Sure. We're located in Cary, and we develop enterprise solutions for small and medium businesses. And we focus on the mobile collection of data and how we transfer that to the servers where we can do data mining and get information from the data that's collected.
So all the kind of mobile devices we have, our smartphones, our iPads, our computers.
Yes, we do all the mobile devices, and we write apps, not so much the games, but apps focused at businesses that want to collect data. We've collected data in the areas. We do a lot of inspection data where people take their laptop and collect inspection information, which we can sort and look for trends and stuff.
And you've done some real estate.
We've done real estate, providing information to the realtors and to people that are on the road and need to collect the data. We also have a medical device where we collect blood pressure and glucose readings at home. It's an FDA-cleared device that allows the doctors to get the information directly to be able to track your data and then to be able to adjust your medications without you actually having to go into the doctor's office.
So you feed that data from the collection point at the home back to the doctor's office, and the doctor's office can know when something needs to be changed.
They can review the data, and we can notify them when you haven't taken your readings or if the readings are out of spec, so they can take action.
Well, that's great. So in your role on IEEE, I know your wife, Mary Ellen, who's the president and founder of Ascot Technologies, is active there. She's traveling now for them. Tell us about IEEE, your role, and what all's going on in that organization, and how it helps everyone.
IEEE is a huge organization. There's 430,000 members worldwide, broken into 10 different regions. IEEE was originally established back in 1884 and with some very famous original people.
I saw that. I think our listeners will have heard of some of those.
Yeah, Thomas Edison, Alexander Graham Bell, some of the people that originally started what was then the AIEE. There was also another organization called the IRE, the Institute for Radio Engineers, back in the early 1900s when we started radio communications. The IRE was established. And then in 1963, the AIEE and the IRE merged to become IEEE, Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers.
And so what's the mission of IEEE?
IEEE has several missions. The primary mission is to advance technology for humanity. The role is to try to bring together technology so that we can help people. And that comes in a lot of different ways. We have the obvious, the humanitarian projects. We have a lot of work going on in Africa. We did a lot of work in Haiti where we provided power and solar panels to help bring schools and homes back online, places that don't have power. We have like 190 periodicals that we publish. The IEEE has 19 of the top 20 most cited periodicals.
Got to get that 20th one, too.
Yeah, we're working on it. We're getting there. So we do a lot of publishing and do a lot of articles.
So who gets to join IEEE?
Anybody can join IEEE.
So you don't have to be an engineer or anything?
No. Nope. Okay. It's focused. It tends to be more engineers. But we have, we're broken into what we call societies, and each society focuses on a particular aspect of engineering. But those, they're not necessarily hard engineerings. We have a society that's focused on management.
Okay.
How do you manage, engineers, which is somewhat of a challenge for
many. It's been likened like with scientists herding cats.
Yes. So
you guys are so creative, and then you're so structured. So, sometimes that's just not consistent with the management practices that a lot of businesses have.
Right, yeah. Engineers think a little differently than
he can say
people.
That.
Yes. So we do all that. So among a lot of through the publications, we do a lot of research institutes, a lot of universities publish through the IEEE. We also do over 100,000 conferences a year sponsored by the IEEE.
100,000?
Mm-hmm.
Around the world, I'm assuming.
Around the world, yep. So IEEE sponsors, a lot of conferences and things like that.
And those conferences are on, what kind of topic? Is it on robotics? Is it on the autonomous vehicles? What kind of topics are at those conferences?
Yeah, you name it. With that many conferences, there's probably one on
They're usually scientific,
anything.
Engineering topics. So.
Yes. It's usually engineering-related, advancing technologies in a wide variety of fields. When it's IEEE started, we were originally electrical and electronics, but mm-hmm. today we have 39 societies that of different aspects of engineering, and it goes anywhere from aerospace and airplanes to electronics to marine, space mapping, geospace society. So there's just a huge variety of areas that the IEEE.
So you're the North Carolina Eastern Section Chair.
That's
so
right.
Tell us about that actual section. When do you guys meet? What do you guys do in your meetings and all those kind of things?
Okay, so So the IEEE organization starts at the section level, and the section is an area, a geographic area, where we bring together the engineers in our section. Eastern North Carolina has 3,000 members in our section. We cover the RTP area out to the coast.
Okay.
So we get the whole eastern side of the state.
But I thought I read in your notes that there were 5 sections in North Carolina. So North Carolina, the rest of the state's divided into 4 sections.
Right. Okay. So there's an area, a section in the Charlotte area. There's a section in Greensboro, one in West Winston-Salem, and then there's the western section out in Nashville. So,
and are they as big as the ones in the eastern, or membership-wise, 3,000 people?
No, the Eastern North Carolina section is the second largest in the southeast.
Okay.
So, because we're broken into regions, there's 10 regions in the world. We're in Region 3, which goes basically from Virginia to Florida and out through Alabama and up through Tennessee. So that's the region. Within the region, Atlanta is larger than us, but we're the second largest.
Well, that's kind of Atlanta's bigger, so yeah.
A little hard to challenge them. So
you have a monthly meeting, or how do the section meetings go?
It works is there is a section meeting once. We try to do it once a month. Normally, it's frequently at NC State. We'll get rooms there and invite people. But all of our chapters, we have 12 of the 39 societies. We have 12 chapters here locally in this section.
Okay, so that's the engineering or specialty within that. So within the section, 12 of the societies are represented by their own operating chapters.
Right. So they each have their own individual meeting schedules. We invite anybody to our meetings. I always found this to be kind of interesting because we openly invite anybody is welcome to attend our meetings. And I always wondered, well, why do I pay dues?
For everybody else to come?
Yes. But it's amazing. We have a very high percentage of people that attend join.
Right.
So we welcome them. You're welcome to come to any of the
IEEE. So it's good for the college students, those exploring, thinking they're wanting to go in the engineering field. They can connect with the people experienced in those fields and really engage before they've even graduated from college.
Oh, absolutely. We have worldwide, I think the number is 120,000 students that participate with IEEE. It's very active in the university. One of the things we work on is moving the students into regular membership, because some students tend to lose track of the IEEE when they get done school. But the IEEE is... We try to do a lifelong management of your career. We want you to be part of the IEEE community. We have an affinity group called Young Professionals, and that consists of engineers that have been out of school less than 10 years. So they have their own organization within IEEE where they can get together work and learn about, you know, how they can improve their career.
We have a lot of education programs, because when I was on the website, I could see that there were a lot of education programs available to anyone. You didn't have to be an IEEE member to take a class in those. And that's unique, too.
Yeah. Well, education's an important part of IEEE, because not only are we want the engineers to network and come together and do projects together, but we want to help keep them at state of the art.
Well, because you're focused on innovation, so if you don't continue to learn after you've gotten your basic degree, then how are you going to innovate?
Yeah, and the technology fields change dramatically.
Every minute. The way it feels on this end.
Yeah. I was going to say every year, but it's very difficult to keep up in a lot of the leading fields. So the role of IEEE is to help make this information available through our publications and through our conferences. But we also, at the section level, provide these meetings to help engineers share and to learn about what the current technologies are.
So are the section and the chapter meeting notices on the IEEE website?
Yes.
So IEEE.org? And they can go out there for the for all the chapter meetings and all those kinds of things?
Well, there is a section website.
Okay. And you can give them the website. Do you have it with you? I didn't tell him I was going to ask.
Yeah, it's if you go to your favorite internet search engine and just type IEEE space ENCS for Eastern North Carolina section, normally it will pop right up and you can get to
it. And I have the whole long, you did give it to me. Of course, the http://sites.ieee.org/ENCS/. So it is in my notes.
That will get you to the local website for our local activities.
But anyone in any state or around the world can go out to the main IEEE site and start looking for societies and chapters and information in there.
Absolutely, yes. There are meetings held worldwide.
Probably just about every day if there's something going on with 100,000 conferences and all of these chapters.
Tremendous amount of activity that happens at the IEEE.
Well, that's exciting. So let's talk about some of the innovations that you're working on and IEEE is working on. So a humanoid robot.
The humanoid robot project.
I'm going to have to say, I told him it sounded like one of the science fiction shows I grew up with. But tell how we're making it reality.
Well, it is in a way. Humanoid robots have long been in the books and in the science fiction. And today's technologies with the smaller processors and the capability to have more memory and to have better sensors and stuff is really brought the robotics world together. And you can't read anything in the paper without talking about drones and ground robots and autonomous cars and what we call the receptionist robots, which are the humanoids that look like people and can walk around and interact.
So what is the expectation, though, for those? Are they one day expected? And is it the vision that you're not going to be able to distinguish them from a human?
Well,
and so they'll be fully functional. You can hire them as your butler instead of a person.
That is the goal.
Okay.
There's a lot of work being done, and there's a lot of discussion within the industry whether how realistic you want to make the robots. And there's a lot of people that are very nervous about having robots that look like humans.
Because it's like we probably all remember Battlestar Galactica and things from our childhood where the humanoids were trying to get rid of the humans. But that raises an interesting question. The more innovative we are with our technologies, how fast are our ethics and our boundaries being set up to go along with those innovations and those things? What makes sense and what doesn't make sense?
There's a lot of discussion going on in that area. Not only the technology people working on making the robots and making that happen, there are a lot of people, a lot of very famous people, talking about artificial intelligence and robotics and humanoid robotics and how that comes together and how we're going to control and manage.
Are we trying to create this because we can, or are we trying to create it because we want it to go in to do the dangerous things that we don't want to put human lives at risk, or both?
It's a wide range of things. Certainly, a lot of funding comes from the government initially to be applied for military reasons.
Right.
I mean, some people disagree with that, but the reality is that's how a lot of the initial funding happens, particularly here in the United States.
Well, most of our technology gets funded in the States for the early innovations through the government, because there's no one else that can take the risk or have the deep pockets.
Right. And this humanoid robotics is a particularly interesting problem for smaller companies, because you have to have a wide range of expertise. It isn't one thing.
Right.
The robotics project that we have in Eastern North Carolina section, I'll just step back a second.
Okay.
Is that we formed this project to engage our members.
Okay.
The engineers love to build
the
things.
Intellectual challenge.
They love to be challenged. So we put this project in place to get people together and get them to work on something that is challenging. So we have a vision team. We're working okay. on being able to recognize things, being able to recognize people, and that's a very difficult problem. There's a lot of research
right.
being
so
done
it's
in
like
the area
taking
of vision.
The facial recognition software, the software that the military uses to flip through signals and boat shapes and all those kind of things to figure out what's there and taking it to make it into a eyes for the robot.
That's right.
Okay.
We also have a hearing and speech team, being able to for the robot to talk in what sounds like a natural language is actually very difficult. Everybody's talked to the robot on the telephone, and it's a very, it's a robot, it's very
right.
animated type of a voice. So we're working on making the voice
non-robotic.
Non-robotic. Recognizing speech is very difficult.
Yeah. If anybody's ever used the speech recognition software to dictate, and you have to pick the right accent. So, like, I have to pick the Southern accent type of English right. and those kind of things. So, yeah. And then it still gets things wrong.
And that's when you're talking into the microphone. Mm-hmm. When we're trying to collect sounds, when there's multiple people in the room, there's background noise, there's things happening,
right.
very difficult to sort out the individual speech tracks and to be able to correctly convert those into things that we can use in our computers.
Well, then it would be not only it would be vocabulary, different languages, different pitches, the truck driving by, the train going off, yeah. the sirens, all of those kind of things.
All of those things interfere. And a lot of words have multiple meanings, so you're trying to figure out if you use, he or they.
Homonyms then. So, yeah. There's so many things that sound alike but have no relation
right.
in the thing.
So we're continuing to work to make better speech. We have an artificial intelligence team, which is basically collects the what we're seeing, it collects what we're hearing, and it ties together. When I see you, I can go out and pull your name so I can address you by name. It remembers our last discussion so that it can remember to ask you about your children.
So it's essentially filing, like our brain does, it files it away in a certain place, but it's just putting it on a hard drive.
Right.
For want of a better way.
And then we need a way to correlate and pull that information back so that we can recreate or use that information in a conversation with the
And you just
person.
Think about somebody meets me today and they meet me 10 years from now. That computer's got to be able to make the connection in the aging process, not that I intend to age in 10 years, but all of those things that can be different, your hair, your height, your weight, your all of those kind of things. And so finding even those points of reference in the face maybe to even stay and then say, okay, now I have to go get Lee's folder and I have to recognize her 10 years later.
Yes, yes.
So that's kind of, yeah.
Very, very challenging problem. We can collect an unimaginable amount of information
right.
because, things are happening in the scene while you're looking around. There's tons of stuff to take in and we can and try to organize that and store it such that we can recall it at a later time when we need to reference it.
Well, and the things that you're doing with the artificial intelligence and those types of systems could ultimately spin off and have benefits to people with brain injury. There's lessons to learn in pursuing that could be applied to the human existence and what can help with those kinds of things.
Yes, there's a lot of people working. Artificial intelligence has been a point of interest for many years and
decades.
Yes, and we're continuing to work in those areas. So
that's cool. And then I'm assuming the mobility type thing. So
right, and then we have a
locomotion,
a structure team,
yeah.
which is the physical robot that he's currently called Ken.
Is there a Barbie?
Not yet.
Okay.
So, but Ken has the capability to has full mobility of his head and neck, and can track you and look at you while he's talking to you. And so.
So is he attached to a body? Or is he just a head at this point?
We're on the initial phase.
Okay.
We have several. We have plans that. We can work on this for years.
Yes.
The initial plan, he basically sits on the table. He's like from the chest up. So, you know, he has we're basically working on conversation and recognition. And a lot of other companies, and particularly Japan, is very far ahead.
And I've read some things Australia is doing, too.
Yes. So there's other countries that are very quite a ways ahead of us in the field.
I think Japan has the teacher in the room, the one that they can have a teacher robot.
Yeah, they have a number of robots that are very impressive, and they've been working on them for a number of years. So our goal is to try to help the U.S. Kind of catch up.
So is the North Carolina's Eastern Section Chair the only kind of independent project like that within IEEE, or other sections having robotic projects also?
There's a Robotics and Automation Society. It's one of the vertical societies in IEEE, and they're doing research around the world in different areas of robotics, of humanoids being one. A lot of the research is done on specific aspects of the robot. And I kind of started to talk about this earlier, but one of the big problems with companies trying to create humanoid robotics is you need all these teams. Mm-hmm. You need experts in vision. You need experts in speech and hearing. You need experts in AI. You need experts in the physical robot and stuff. And most companies, it's a long development cycle and very expensive to do this technology.
Because they can't usually structure the entire team, and they have to go out and rent for one of them, pull this person in when they need it,
right,
and those kind of things.
So we have a unique opportunity at the IEEE because we have 430,000 engineering experts that we have access to, and we actually are working locally but have the capability to draw from expertise from around the world.
So here's a business question. Who gets the patent on what these teams do?
Well,
TBD.
You know that's a very difficult question. It's one that I've struggled with because I like to do volunteer projects.
Right.
And I like to develop. The patent process is always fly in the ointment, and it's very difficult to do. What I found and what we're doing through the IEEE is we open source the work. So we don't own any of the patents. The work that we do is made available
to everyone through the public.
To anybody that wants to take this and enhance it.
So how's the U.S. government feel about that? Or have they weighed in on those kind of projects when it's open sourcing and this kind of technology, or do you know?
Well,
you can say you don't know. I'm hitting with an expectation.
From what aspect?
If they fund an innovation or a technology project in these kind of fields. Like you said, there's a lot of military applications that they can do with this. Here we are sitting here with these tremendous U.S. brains doing this, and yet what's being discovered will ultimately be available to anybody in the world to take advantage of.
Yeah. There are export issues and things that you have to be careful about. But in general, the technology is open and can be developed. The government, in most cases, likes to see that development because ultimately they will take it and expand on it in areas that we don't address. And they can take advantage. It's kind of like we raise the water, all the boats go up, you know. So it hasn't been an issue. We're not doing using it for things that the government is particularly concerned about at this point.
Yeah, right. When you guys have it walking down the street and functioning, they'll come knocking on your door.
Yeah.
So what other kind of projects are you doing? So you're doing the humanoid robots. You are doing autonomous vehicles.
Yes. Let me talk briefly about the Robo Research.
Okay.
I am chair of a seminar in March that will take place in Charlotte called Robo Research Seminar. And what I have done is pulled together a team from the state of North Carolina to address robotics research and development within the state. And this seminar is bringing in state government. We have a speaker from the Department of Commerce coming. We've invited the university systems to present research that's going on in the field of robotics. And we've also invited local industry within the state. And the goal is to bring everybody together and to try to make North Carolina a hub for robotics development. We have a tremendous amount of technology, particularly in the RTP area. Charlotte has a lot of technology development as well. And there's other assorted stuff throughout the state. So we're really trying to pull together, leverage the wonderful university system we have, leverage the industry that we have, and combine that with the state to really increase the amount of development done in North Carolina.
And that's March 6th, and where is it being held in Charlotte?
It's being held at the UNC Charlotte, the university.
And if they want to sign up to attend, is there a cost or?
The seminar is free to attend, but you need to register. We have a limited number of seats available, and actually we've had wonderful sign-ups so far. So
let me give the site, the website to go to. So that's the 2015 IEEE Robo Research Seminar.
Correct.
It's at sites.ieee.org/ncc-robo-research/. And so if you're interested in attending, go out and register today.
Yes, absolutely.
And get the information there and get involved.
Yes.
So you have another event happening in March, correct? This is first annual event in March? Or is that the Charlotte Robo Research?
That's the Robo Research event, right. That's the first of, I hope, many.
Annual, then.
Yes. But we're really looking to help accelerate the robotics within the state.
So one of the other things that's on, excuse me, that I know you've been engaging in is those autonomous vehicles.
Yes.
We think of drones, but they can be in the air, they can be on the ground. And what's going on in those fields? Because, you know, we're hearing Amazon wants to deliver with them and those kind of things. So what do we need to know about autonomous vehicles and all the exciting things that are going on with those?
Well, everybody, you can't read the paper without hearing about autonomous cars and what's coming.
Or drones on the White House lawn.
On the drones, yeah. There's a tremendous amount happening with that. Back in, 2003 timeframe, the federal government, particularly through DARPA, which is the
Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, I think.
That's correct. Yeah. They're the government research arm, and they're out trying to find and fund advanced technologies.
So they're looking for the cutting-edge new ideas, right, and getting those out there.
So back in 2003, they wanted to automate their supply trucks so that they could do deliveries in dangerous areas.
So the Ford missions in Iraq or Afghanistan, those kind of places.
Correct. So they were without involving the humans. They wanted to take the humans out, so if the truck is destroyed, there would be no human life. So and to do that, they decided to do what at the time was very unique, but they established basically a contest. They said, we'll give $1 million to anybody that can complete a 120-mile drive through the desert, and the vehicle cannot have a human on board and cannot be remotely controlled. It has to be self-contained.
Okay, so it had to be programmed and execute. So at least from the starting line, program engages and it goes.
Yep, it gets turned on, it leaves the starting gate. And drives for 120 miles.
I'm assuming not in a straight line.
No. No, it was an interesting course, had a variety of different areas. So
it was an actual terrain test. You didn't put 120 miles on a racetrack.
No, it was out in the
desert,
southeast desert, Nevada, actually.
And so what was that process to, how did you start to create a vehicle? Did you take a regular car and then start from there?
Yep. There were 189 teams that signed up for the DARPA Grand Challenge. We were one of them. And we actually, for the first event, there were actually two events. For the first event, we just got an old Chevy Suburban and put together a team that converted it to be fully autonomous. It had controls to control the steering wheel. We controlled the brake and the gas. And then we added sensors so we could detect the land, the surfaces around us, and to actually create a path that was allowable for the
vehicle. So there was something scanning ahead of it so it could tell where it was going, and then things that picked up sensors of obstacles on the road, edges of the road, and those kind of things?
Right. We used a device called the LIDAR, which is basically a laser beam that we're able to use. It's much like you can buy them in the store if you want to measure the room. You can click the little laser and it'll tell you the distance. Well, this device is actually a scanner. It would actually scan 180 degrees and give us the depth of every object within that sweep. And we can actually, from that, you can actually form a map that shows where all the objects are. And so we combine that with camera information and some radar information, and you can actually build an image of everything that's around the car.
So the car gets all this information coming from these systems and then has a program that enables it to adapt to that and steer?
Absolutely.
Change speeds?
Yep. So we actually generate a map of the environment so we know everything that's going on around the car, and then we actually plan a path that is safe to proceed. So we actually drive around objects.
So when you say you see it and you plan it, did you get to, you knew the terrain in advance and then you programmed for that? Or is there something in the program that says, okay, there's a boulder in the road, so I need to turn left?
It had to be fully autonomous.
Okay, so it had to have that decision making.
At the starting line, we were given a thumb drive with the actual path, and we had 3 minutes to load it into the vehicle.
A whole 3 minutes.
And to back off and start the vehicle. And the vehicle then left the starting line. We had never seen the path that it was asked to take, nor did we know what it was at the time. So,
wow. That's interesting. So how you said there were 189 teams, and did they participate in both challenges? You said there were two challenges, or did it winnow it down?
Well, the first one was 189 teams. There was a rather long process for getting to the final race. There was you had to submit videos, and if you were, that eliminated a lot of the teams. Then there was a site visit where DARPA actually came to each individual site and did a day-long evaluation. And then there were 20 vehicles that were actually selected to go to the race in California, Nevada.
And so you went out there and you raced twice.
So, well, yes. Yes. Okay. So the first race was the desert race, and that was the 120 miles through the desert. The second race was called the Urban Challenge. And the Urban Challenge was to take place in basically a city environment. We had to handle four-way intersections. We had to handle traffic circles. We had to be able to park, as well as to interact with the other traffic that
was
flowing.
Now, the parallel parking program would come in handy. So did you use it in a real city, or was it a mock-up, or how did they do that?
They actually did it on a decommissioned Air Force base.
Okay.
Where they actually had the residential community. There were houses and garages and curbs. And
but you weren't dealing with tractor trailers and changing speeds and all of those kind of things.
No.
Okay, closed space.
Now, DARPA had traffic on the course. They had cars driving around, and so there were other cars there that we did have to interact with, but it was not the general public.
It wasn't the LA freeway at rush hour. So, well, that's fascinating. So, are there society sections within IEEE that just focus on autonomous vehicles and those kind of things?
Yes, there's a lot of work in IEEE being done on autonomous vehicles. Whether they're ground vehicles or air vehicles.
Or water.
There's a lot of work being done on underwater robotics as well. In particular, IEEE is well known for its standards. We talked about publications, and we've talked about our members. The IEEE standards, almost everybody uses Wi-Fi, which is IEEE 802 standard. You've used FireWire or, you know.
Yes.
Any of, we have tens of thousands of different
everyday standards that we live with.
Standards that we work with every day are created by the members of IEEE.
So you're talking about all the hundreds of publications you guys have. Is there one that goes along with each society interest? So there's one on autonomous vehicles or something on robotics and those kind of things?
It's usually by society.
Okay.
So the different societies publish
their interests.
Right. They usually have a regular magazine type article, but then all of the research and stuff gets published into IEEE arena where it's all collected. So not only do we have the regular like magazine publications, but you can search through IEEE
the database of all
3.5 million articles, I think, that are currently in our database.
Just 3.5. So, I mean, there's a lot going on there. And then you said there's a humanitarian application of this. IEEE takes this technology, takes these volunteers, because it's 100% volunteer organization, correct?
Yeah, it's very amazing having, you know, worked in industry and stuff. A 430,000 person organization, and it's all volunteer right through the president each year.
So if you go out and do the humanitarian effort, it's everybody going on their own to go out to Africa or to Haiti to put a power plant in place or to do something that intervenes and changes the way people are living at that moment.
Yes. Yes, humanitarian efforts are an important part of IEEE, and we fund a lot of projects to do that. It's interesting because one of the projects, the MOVE project, originally started here in Eastern North Carolina.
And what's the MOVE project?
MOVE is the Mobile Operations Vehicle, and that is a project that actually started out of Superstorm Sandy. The IEEE headquarters is actually in New Brunswick, New Jersey.
Mm, okay.
And when Superstorm Sandy came in, it actually devastated. It shut down our data centers. The paid staff, IEEE does have paid staff. We were unable to contact them to find out their locations and their well-being.
Were they okay? All that kind of stuff. Right.
So after that settled down, we actually had a meeting with a lot of the survivors from that area, the IEEE members. And many of them talked about being out of contact. Their phones went dead.
Yeah, because people don't necessarily have landlines anymore. They live by their cell phone. If you can't charge your cell phone or the cell tower is down,
there's
no communication.
And they were out of power for some of them 10 or 12 days. And they were scared at night because they had no lights. They were afraid of being looted and stuff. So out of that came the MOVE project. And the MOVE project is an emergency vehicle that can be moved into disaster areas. Initially, it was targeted for the U.S. for tornadoes, for
hurricanes, snowstorms like Boston.
Boston, yeah. So, and basically the truck will deliver, it has a couple of missions. One is we're going to deliver power packs to individuals. It turns out that most of the emergency response to these large disasters is for the emergency responders.
Yeah, because they're hampered. They don't have power either.
Right. It's important that they get their power and they get their communications up. And the general public doesn't get the same level of response. So the MOVE project was designed to bring to those that don't have power these power packs that can recharge your phone. They have a solar panel on them, so you can recharge them yourself in the day, and a little flashlight in a little unit.
I have one in my bag.
Yes,
right?
Yeah. And we're going to pass those out to people that need them. And we have the capability on this truck to recharge them, so you can pass them back in, and we'll give you another one, and we'll exchange them.
And you'll charge it again.
And at the same time, the truck has communications capability so that we can actually connect you through the hotspot so that you can interact and let people know where you are.
So it's a mobile hotspot. It'll have the ability to connect to towers and phones and those kind of things.
And satellite, yeah. Right.
For those who didn't have a phone or any source to do that.
So, right.
Okay.
And we'll also be able to collect information and distribute it. So a lot of the people in that disaster area didn't know what to do. They didn't know. They had no power. They didn't know.
Yeah, they don't know to go to this station because nobody can hear a radio to say, well, the FEMA station's over here.
Right. Yeah. They don't know where to go, whether to stay in place or try to get out of town or what to do.
Right.
So we'll be able to collect that information and provide through large panels on the truck and through other print media,
right,
you know, what the situation is and what they can do to survive.
So are you expecting that MOVE vehicle to be engaged and somehow notified when FEMA issues a thing? You guys deploy? Is it going to be part of the government system, or are you guys independent of that? Or both?
There's a lot of discussion going on. The FEMA management protocol is very complicated.
Yes.
And it's very...
it's the government, so yeah. It's going to be even complicated.
So that's certainly part of it. But we also are looking at potentially partnering with the power companies, because it's the power companies that really take the hit during these events when they are struggling to get their power back online, that we'd be able to come in and to help mitigate that problem.
Well, because as they get on, frequently it gets overloaded by everybody trying to get back on it at that point in time.
Right.
Yeah, so there's a lot of challenges.
So,
well, that's outstanding. So the future of IEEE, we've got like 6 minutes left of the show. What is 2015 looking like for IEEE, for MOVE, for the humanitarian projects? What can people get involved in today within IEEE and make a difference about?
Well, we have 3 major events scheduled for 2015. We have an awards ceremony coming up later this spring. We always do a summer event where it's a networking event where we invite everybody to. In the past, we've gone to a ball game or to a museum, and it's just a chance for everybody to get together, to bring the family. A lot of our members, you know, don't always have their families, so we try to get the families involved as well. And then in the fall, it's the section's 50th anniversary this year. So we have a big event planned for, I believe it's the November time frame, to celebrate the 50th anniversary of our section.
And so if someone wants to attend a section meeting, they just, when's the next section meeting scheduled?
I don't have the...
Okay.
have it in front of me. But go to our website.
The sites.ieee.org/ENCS.
That's correct. Eastern North Carolina section. We'll be posting all the section meetings, and all of the chapter meetings are posted there. If you want to get involved in the humanoid robot project. If you want to be involved in the, we're starting up a management society chapter, and there's a long list of chapters: engineering and medicine and biology, the robotics chapter. We have a women in engineering chapter, computer society, communication society. A long list. Just look us up. If you don't find what you're looking for, you're welcome to contact me, g.randall, R-A-N-D-A-L-L, at IEEE.org, and I'll be glad to connect anybody up that's interested in participating.
So we've talked about it as, you know, college students participating, but can high school and junior high school students come to these meetings and participate in things that are interested in robotics and all those kind of things?
Certainly.
Because you guys support STEM and all those kind of things.
Yes, we do a lot of work with STEM. One of our largest robotics and automation chapter meetings was with a local organization called Wake Robotics. And we had like 120 people show up at a single meeting. And so there's a huge interest in STEM, the high school programs, whether it's somebody like Wake Robotics or any of the many FIRST teams that are in the community.
For those who don't know, Wake Robotics is a nonprofit group that works with the school age, I believe junior high and high school students.
They actually do K to
12. K to 12, okay.
And I've actually seen, you know, 6-year-olds give presentations to a large organization.
And we have to have them on the show, and we're working on that. But what does Wake Robotics do with the kids, and how does IEEE interface with that?
Well, Wake Robotics' role is to engage students in STEM activities, and they do a fabulous job all the way from the little kids up through the high school kids and finding activities that interest them and engage them. The success rate, the students that evolve out of those projects do phenomenally well in college and move on to wonderful things. So the IEEE supports that. We just gave them an award last year for their outreach programs that they do to go out to the schools and to engage students to learn more about science and technology and how they can participate in those fields.
Well, you have to think the 6-year-old doesn't know there's nothing that they can't do, right? Because they're going to be looking there and say, well, why can't I make it through this?
Yes.
And so that innovation that can take place and that excitement there, they can stop building with Legos and start building with, you know, cogs and gears and wires at this age.
Yep.
And put their iPads to work and all those kind of things. So it's amazing what kids can do at those ages. So we have 2 minutes left. If you had to tell anything, one thing that we have not told the listeners about IEEE, about ASCOT, about MOVE, what else do you want to share with the listeners today?
I guess I'd just like to reiterate that IEEE is all volunteer. All the work that we do, both locally and internationally, is for the betterment of society. There's a place for everybody. There's all kinds of activities. And the more people that we can engage and that can participate with us, the more things that we can do as an organization to help society, to help move the engineering fields along, to help work with the students and to help, you know, bring them into the engineering fields as well.
Well, and I know I directed one of my clients to the jobs board for IEEE. They were looking for engineers. And so there's that kind of assistance, too, for engineers and everyone that members to go out and look for job transitions and information on that, too.
Yep. We do education. We have job boards. We work very hard for our members to, you know, because it's all volunteer, we look for the members to help drive what direction we go in and what we need to be doing in the future.
Well, and as mobile as everyone is in this society, the fact that there are so many chapters and sections and regions that when you move from one place to the other, there's already a community there waiting for you within IEEE.
IEEE is everywhere.
They're yes. everywhere.
And we really look to keep our members through their whole career. We, you know, from the new engineers up through our life members that have been there and continue to help drive and support a lot of the programs and the organizational things that we do at IEEE.
So let me give out the website again for IEEE. It's IEEE.org. The Eastern North Carolina section is sites.IEEE.org/ENCS. The 2015 first annual IEEE Robo Research Seminar that's going to be held in Charlotte. For more information on that and to register, go to sites.IEEE.org/NCC-Robo Research. And if you want to find out what Ascot Technologies is doing, visit their website. That's ascottechnologies.com. That's ascottechnologies.com. And I'm going to thank Grayson for being on the show today and for sharing all these insights into IEEE and humanoid robotics. I'm going to be checking out a little bit more on that myself. And until next time, everyone, stay focused on the important things. And I want to take a moment to thank our nonprofits in the area and our sponsors. Focus on Business and WCOM FM are proud to support the Ronald McDonald House of Durham. To learn more about the Ronald McDonald House of Durham, visit their website at www.ronaldhousedurham.org. That's www.ronaldhousedurham.org or give them a call at 919-281-1065. WCOM-FM and Focus on Business are proud to support Make-A-Wish of Eastern North Carolina, serving the Triangle. Make-A-Wish of Eastern North Carolina is your community Make-A-Wish. To learn more about what Make-A-Wish is doing, visit their website at www.eastnc.wish.org. That's www.eastnc.wish.org or give them a call at 1-800-432-WISH. That's 1-800-432-9474. Focus on Business and WCOM-FM would like to thank Focus Resources for underwriting the Focus on Business radio program. Their website is focusresourcesinc.com.